Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. In late January, during President Trump's second inaugural address, he stated, quote, "The United States will once again consider itself a growing nation, one that increases our wealth, expands our territory, builds our cities, raises our expectations, and carries our flag into new and beautiful horizons. As we will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars." There was also a mention in the speech of the Panama Canal and its connection and importance to our economic and national security, including the access of our Navy. Now, while a short speech is not designed to explain everything that was said in it, a podcast can get to a little bit of it. So today we will investigate the history of the how, what, and why behind the Panama Canal and what lessons it can teach space strategists in the administration and Congress about what will be needed for the Space Force if we are truly going to pursue our manifest destiny into the stars. So to discuss this topic is Dr. M.V. Coyote Smith, Professor of Strategic Space Studies at the Air Force's Air Command and Staff College. He's also the lead for the Grissom Space Course, which is a great program that is geared to teach the importance of space superiority. So thanks for coming back on again, the program, Coyote. And just real quick, before all the lawyers get all excited, nothing that we say is any representation of the places that we work. Everything is the host's opinions or the guest's opinions. So go ahead, Coyote. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here. And yeah, like you say, the opinions that I share here today are my own, and they do not represent the U.S. government or the United States Air Force or Air University.
But they should. So to get our listeners up to speed, introduce the audience to how we got to a Panama Canal and how and why a naval strategist that you're familiar with named Alfred Thayer Mahan had a large influence on the nation's pursuit of this project.
It's a great question, and this is so timely. The Panama Canal was based on an economic need to shorten the distance between the Atlantic and Pacific for naval vessels and also especially for merchant ships. The trip between the East Coast of the United States used to have to swing around the tip of South America to make it over to the Pacific Ocean. This was highly costly to our merchant fleet and also time prohibitive to our Navy. We had looked into creating a canal in Panama as early as the late 1880s and 1890s. In fact, a French company who had successfully completed the Suez Canal started the Panama Canal project. However, poor planning and tropical diseases and some financial mismanagement led to the ruin of that program. This was about the same time that an author in the U.S. Navy named Alfred Thayer Mahan published a book that became a blockbuster in naval military theory, and that was The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Notably in that book, Mahan said that in order to be a great power, a nation needs to be a seafaring power, because no nation, no matter how you are configured, has all of the resources at your command trapped inside your geographic boundaries for you to do the types of commercial marketing, production, manufacturing and fabrication in order to become a leading trade partner. So he strongly advocated that the United States needed to become a two-ocean navy, such that a canal in Panama would enable ships to flow quickly between the Atlantic and the Pacific. It also would allow global trade and economic power development to accrue to the United States, as we were able to go out and harvest resources in the rest of the world in a free trade environment. We could bring those resources back, fabricate and manufacture products that we could use our ships to sail back to deliver to markets around the world. And of course, national security was tied directly to the Panama Canal in terms of the Navy's ability to flex between oceans.
Awesome. Now, for those that may not be aware, President Teddy Roosevelt, while he was president during the construction of the canal and did a lot of work to recognize Panama as a sovereign country, which, frankly, if it weren't for the United States, Panama would not exist as a sovereign nation. But back before that, late 1890s, like you mentioned, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the late 1800s, and he himself was a naval strategist of sorts and a grand thinker in his own right. And he met with Mahan. I think he met him at the Naval War College during some lectures that he was doing. And in a sense, he kind of found a kindred spirit. And if the nation was to become a great power in his mind and influential in world affairs, then the Monroe Doctrine that came way before that, 1820s or so, would have to be enforced. And as you mentioned, merchant ships would have to have ready access to both Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. So can you provide a bit of a history on this Monroe Doctrine and maybe even the Roosevelt Corollary and why this is all important as part of this backstory?
You know, it's really interesting. Back in the 1800s, President Monroe crafted what was called the Monroe Doctrine. It was set into place in 1823. And it was a crucial ideological and strategic backdrop for the U.S. pursuit of the Panama Canal when its time came. As it was conceived, it was designed, that Monroe Doctrine, to block European influence in the New World. In 1823, we were still worried that European powers would come and interfere with the newly independent United States. It was also used, and over the years, as justification for U.S. intervention to block foreign influence from flowing into the Americas. We can think as recently as President Reagan's intervention into Grenada to keep Cuban and Soviet influence out of this hemisphere. And that has continued. Now, as you mentioned, the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, Roosevelt was president between 1901 and 1909, but he very clearly communicated his corollary of walk softly, but carry a big stick. And it's known in international politics as the big stick diplomacy. In other words, hard power has a soft power all its own. And if you have a very strong military and a navy that can get you to the international corners of the world, and you can flex that power, you have a soft power that accrues to you in that other nations will seek to give you favor. And it was also used over time to secure U.S. naval and economic power, hearkening back to the theories of Alfred Thayer Mahan. So during Roosevelt's presidency, during the ascendancy of Alfred Thayer Mahan's theory, you can see how those concepts interleave to kind of create the direction that America went and why we desired to pursue building the Panama Canal. Roosevelt started that project in 1904. Originally, Panama was owned by Colombia, and we had tried some diplomatic efforts with Colombia to get a canal, but that had failed. By 1904, there was a Panamanian separatist movement that Roosevelt supported. And of course, in 1904, that revolution succeeded. And it was followed immediately by backing by the Roosevelt administration for the construction of the canal.
Right, including the use of naval power as necessary to support that separatist movement that was supportive of us building the canal in their soon to be new territory. So taking it to modern times with all that background, a lot of people may be wondering, why is the president so vocal, the current President Trump? Why is he so vocal about, quote, taking back the Panama Canal? And I know an answer. I think I know where you're going to go, but I want to get your take on this too.
Okay. You know, it goes back to the first Trump administration, and I think there was a fabulous presentation that Newt Gingrich gave. And I believe he characterized President Trump as an amalgamation of three American historical figures, the first one being the populist President Andrew Jackson, the second one being President Teddy Roosevelt, and the last one being P.T. Barnum. The president is a true showman in terms of how he can control a room, control an audience, and of course the camera and the internet as well. I think what comes down to, he has been studying geopolitics apparently, and he's taken a look at the geopolitical positioning of the United States in the world. And he is very concerned and he's very vocal about two things about the Panama Canal. First, he believes that U.S. ships are getting a raw deal, having to pay too high a price to transit through the canal. And he's also very concerned about Chinese influence over Panama with regard to the canal. There was a deal that was cut by Panama back in 1999 when the canal was finally handed over to them. A Chinese company named Hutchins and Whampoa took possession of the berth points, the mooring points on either side of the canal. And therefore, the canal becomes a choke point that I believe President Trump is concerned about the Chinese controlling. Now, there's two ways the Chinese can control that. One is economically, by holding the mooring points on either side of the canal, dictating the flow of ships that can go through the canal. But also they can do it with their Chinese Navy, with submarines sitting off those straighted points at that choke point.
Yeah, so if you could explain what a choke point is to folks, because since this is primarily a space strategy podcast, and we're going to get to the space stuff, so don't worry, folks. What exactly is a choke point, and why is it such a big deal to military and economic planners?
As Alfred Thayer Mahan described a choke point, it's a geographical feature on the Earth which limits the ability to pass traffic. It's kind of like a choke point. The Panama Canal is one such example where a majority of traffic has to pass through it. Another choke point is the Horn of Africa, where vessels that are not passing through the Suez Canal would have to transit the southern point of Africa. I've mentioned the Suez Canal. There are other places like the South China Sea, where the Chinese are building their weaponized islands, which becomes a choke point where such a tremendous percentage of products have to pass through on ships, that very narrow neck. And in 2012, something amazing happened. The climate shifted slightly in the north, opening up the Northwest Passage. And now Russian icebreakers have been smashing that Northwest Passage, creating another choke point where vessels that have commerce or naval interests have to pass. I'd also like to point out that the Bering Sea, where Alaska meets Siberia, is another place that is a choke point.
Right. So if you lose control of these choke points in a conflict or even during standard economic processes, that could lead to a lot of issues for the public, such as increased cost of goods, not just military concerns, but increased cost of goods. And we see some of that over the last few months, year, with the Red Sea shipping being targeted by Houthis and other Iranian proxies. And so I also mentioned that with the Chinese control concerns, the Belt and Road Initiative is something that people might be familiar with listening to this podcast. And if you look at really where all the stuff is, there was a nice cartoon that I think was in the Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs It had a nice picture of this, basically this Chinese boa constrictor basically going around the entire Western Hemisphere with total control of Asia and Europe and Africa and the Middle East, and kind of just basically choking off the Western Hemisphere. So I can see a lot of similarities between some of the concerns that, you know, the French Empire, the British Empire, and other empires back in the day of Teddy Roosevelt might have, concerned him with the need for a canal, and why the current president is concerned on that. However, I will mention that now that we're this is a space podcast, what does this mean for the advancement of what the president calls manifest destiny in the stars? While the canal has enabled the rise of the United States as a great power and later a superpower, how does any of this apply to space power and geostrategy or astrostrategy in the 21st century in an era, as everyone calls it, great power competition? What's your thoughts on that? Are there any lessons learned for a space strategist from all this?
There sure are. Alfred Thayer Mahan remains one of the more popular theorists applied to space power. Writing back in the 19th century, he spoke about how the great powers of the 20th century would have to be significant seafaring powers, that would enable not only their merchant fleets, but also their naval fleets in order to protect their mercantile system. As we apply this to space, it's interesting. A true superpower of the 21st century and even the 22nd century will have to be a significant spacefaring power as well. There are not only resources in space that we can harvest and bring back here to Earth, but we have to keep in mind an analogy I like using. Back in the 1500 era, there were European nations that were in significant debt. They were in debt to their merchant class. It was very difficult for them to pay off, and they resorted to colonialism in the New World and in Africa in order to extract resources to pay down their debt. They not only paid down their debt, but they became the superpowers of for the next several hundred years. The same phenomenon is going to happen in space. As we take a look to space, those nations that will take the investment to place up super constellations of satellites will secure the telecommunications industry and all communications here on the planet, eventually power generation and supply. And as we go to the moon and we find those rare minerals that are so easy to find because there's no biological environment up there that causes the erosion that makes those minerals hard to find here on Earth, we'll be harvesting those and bringing them home.
Yeah, well, I'll mention that the Chinese are very, very big into this. So yeah. While they've been collecting as much of rare earth metals and other things on Earth, which, you know, in our last episode, we talked about Greenland and why that has some connectivity to space as well. But because they pretty much control the majority of earthbound minerals that are important for everything from economic, you know, projects to special weapon systems that we need to defend ourselves, the Chinese have been using that same analogy as part of their planning. I don't remember the name of the Chinese person, but there was one that was mentioning, like, you know, orbit is our first island chain. The moon is the second island chain or something like that. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, there have been several statements by their leaders that have been kind of poetic like that. One of their leaders also said that the moon is China's Taiwan to the rest of the solar system.
Yeah, so they're not just – so basically the – Chinese, which is our biggest considerable issue of the day from a nation state standpoint, both from Earth and in space, is looking at space as in the very way that Coyote that I'm hearing you say. What do you think that this means for the United States? Yeah. Do you think that President Trump, when he's speaking about expanding our territories and planting our flags on new horizons, that even though he didn't specifically mention the economic pieces of space, do you think he's perhaps thinking about why we need to go further out for those very reasons? Or do you think he was just being poetic and not necessarily strategic?
I do think he was being strategic because he has a long-term vision for economic development. That's one of the traits that he and his corporations have had for, you know, several decades. People need to understand that Trump is very different because he's not a native politician. He's a businessman. And one of the things that he's trying to do, and this is going to sound kind of strange, I'm not a Trump spokesman by any stretch of the imagination, but it appears to me that he's trying to get the politics out of government and trying to get the business style of management into government. That creates a much more far-reaching vision because it's like playing pool. Every shot you take has to set you up for the next shot. And that's not the way politicians think, but it is the way our business leaders think. And as he takes a look at expanding the United States, I do think he's talking about expanding upward. There's no new territories left on Earth to go to seize resources to pay off your national debt. If you take a look at our national debt, the only way we're going to do it is by getting a windfall of material from someplace that we can either fabricate or sell itself on the markets. I don't see any other way. And I think the moon provides a tremendous opportunity, as do the asteroids, for harvesting an awful lot of tremendous resources. I think our telecommunications industry, certainly Starlink with over 7,000 satellites on orbit, has established the mega constellation model for using space in order to generate revenue. Resource mining is going to be a necessary next step. Now, in a true Mahanian fashion, we're going to have to secure those areas where we do the harvesting and the transit routes that bring that material home. And that's going to require not just a properly configured merchant fleet behaving in a commercial market appropriately, but also those types of naval analogous space forces that can provide that kind of security.
Well, that's a good segue into my next question. What does the Space Force need to be in order to support this type of strategic vision? I mean, right now, as I've argued for many years since it was anemically birthed back in 2019, what does the Space Force need to have in order to support such a function, especially with the Chinese already building lunar comm repeaters and other infrastructure in cislunar space? And if that is really the case, which it is, what should the Space Force do about it? And how can the president make that happen?
The Space Force, in my humble opinion, needs to take a maritime approach to space. Culturally, it is still stuck in the Air Force. It's still in the Department of the Air Force. It does not understand the idea of going to sea and staying there for months. It's basically office jobs. People go to an office for maybe an eight-hour shift, and you have three rotations of eight-hour shifts managing those constellations on orbit. We need to be thinking from it from the perspective of those satellites. Those satellites are constantly in the sea of space, and those need to be managed as fleets. And we need to have the kinds of systems that can not only do space situational awareness and surveillance, but set in place those bits of infrastructure, much like the Panama Canal, such that we can facilitate the commercial market and secure its ability to generate a profit. The Panama Canal is unique as a piece of infrastructure because it was developed. It is a choke point. But you can access that by giving some money to those that manage the canal. You save money, and that the manager of that canal makes some money in the process. So it's good for everybody. There are things like that, infrastructure that can be put into space. I'm hopeful. Jeff Bezos, just a couple weeks ago, launched into space on his New Glenn rocket a space tug. A space tug is a satellite that can grab another satellite and move that satellite to another location. I'm hoping that a series of space tugs will go to orbit so that companies that want to do spacefaring in deep space won't have to buy super big rockets. They'll just buy small rockets to launch their satellites up into a low Earth orbit. And much like a canal, those that operate space tugs will sell a service to those light satellites and haul them out deeper into space at their parking spot. Both one company will save money and the other company will make money. It is a virtuous cycle.
Yeah. So how can the weapons, because I'll just say this right now, I think the Space Force needs to be able to secure the interests. It's not just an exchange of funds. It's, as you said, hard power has a soft power of its own. And right now, the Space Force is not really a hard power service. At this point, they have a few EW jammers, right? And they have some other things that are probably experimental and some things that can do rendezvous and proximity ops and watch things, which is great. But we don't have any weapon systems to open up a choke point if things get clogged. We don't have the ability to escort, like you say, space tugs and things of that sort. There may come a day in the near future, based on the Chinese, heavy commitment to all this and their rapid buildup of weapon systems in space and even their space to ground type of systems, that would require us to do more. And I know that for whatever reason, people like to look the other way with this issue and think that it's just a matter of terrestrial support. I personally think that, like you said, there needs to be a maritime approach in the sense that I think each orbit should be viewed as a separate area of operations under the space AOR that I think it was General Shaw that was popular for writing about. And I'm going to have him on one of our live events coming up here soon to talk more about that. But is there any type of weapon systems that you think would be necessary in order to secure cislunar space or even orbital space out to the geo belt? Given that's kind of the near-term monetary area of interest.
Yeah, there sure is. And in fact, this is where the theory of Alfred Thayer Mahan sings to the spacefaring community and to those that are space-minded. The fact that we have naval vessels on the ocean that are armed does not generate war. In fact, oftentimes it prevents war. It also becomes elements of diplomacy. It just becomes a good thing for a nation to have to secure its interests with maritime capabilities. And so too, arming space will be no more revolutionary than arming the aircraft or arming the naval vessel. The types of platforms we need to be looking at, first and foremost, need to be those that do not create space debris. Systems such as space-based lasers, space-based electromagnetic pulse weapons, space-based directed energy such as microwave, space-based weaponry such as electronic warfare systems, jammers, etc., can be highly effective at negating adversary hostile attacks against commerce and our own other interests. At some point, yes, there will be space-to-surface weapons. In other words, space will do its part to contribute to the actual providing of fires in the terrestrial environment. And before people become just dismissive of that idea, space assets are often much closer to targets than airborne or sea-based platforms. The boundary into space is only 93 miles away, and we have some satellites that operate routinely around 100 to 150 miles above the surface of the Earth. That's not a very far distance in terms of long-range targeting. We have cruise missiles that do several thousand miles. So I'm not really concerned about the distance of space making it sound impossible. Space is really very close, and our audience needs to understand that.
I agree. And with the, I believe, the Chinese fractional orbital bombardment system test, using everything from potentially nuclear, conventional, and hypersonic glide, you know, obviously that's a thing. That's a reality. The Russians bringing back theirs. And then, of course, with the recent executive order calling for an Iron Dome for America that includes space-based interceptors, they don't specify, it doesn't specify what those interceptors are, but that it will be there to secure the homeland. I could see them being potentially multi-use to secure interest in orbit, depending on where they're deployed and what they are, which I think is also a pretty good thing. Now, I guess finally, I'll just ask this question. I know Elon Musk comes up in a lot of discussions about these types of things, and I have my own view. I don't think, as I mentioned in my recent editorial, I don't think his comments and his thoughts really are bad. I don't think, you know, in particular, the one where everyone is upset, where he says the moon is a distraction, we should go straight to Mars. And of course, you know, he has interest in Mars. He also has interest in the moon. So are you thinking that that as part of the president's strategy, if you will, that because of his former national strategy for space, which I've argued needs to still be his framework for execution, he doesn't need to do a whole new posture review that takes another year, when you already have the framework, just execute, just modify it to include, you know, Mars on different routes. But is there, I'm trying to think of how to ask this, is the moon really a distraction, or do you think that the president understands that it's not, and that he will continue to consider the moon, as you mentioned earlier, as a resource location of importance?
The truthful answer is I don't know. I can tell you what I hope. I hope they don't ignore the moon. It's right there. It's just 2.5 days away from in transit time. It's shorter to go to the moon than it is to go to Europe on a ship. It's just too good to ignore, and it's too present. Now, Musk may have his own goals and objectives. They don't necessarily need to comport with anybody else's. Apparently, he's got the means that if he wants to go to Mars, he's going to Mars. That does not mean the United States should disregard the moon. In fact, if we do, we're disregarding a tremendous source of mineral wealth and other types of opportunities that accrue to us. For example, you know, the moon and the Earth are a system. And if we want to make a cycler orbit between the Earth-Moon system and Mars, possessing the moon or having locations on the moon that we can use will be critical to reducing the overall launch costs if we can get to a time where production takes place on the moon or we stage off the moon to make those trips. Now, I'm not suggesting that we run out and invest trillions of dollars into technologies that don't exist yet. There is the innovator's mandate that each step that we take has to capitalize and provide a commercial profit on its own before we take those next steps forward. But it is a matter of the government has a responsibility of setting into place those types of pieces of infrastructure that can buy down the costs for our entrepreneurs and our commercial marketeers to go out and make a profit in space. The Panama Canal was one example here on Earth. Space tugs, as I've given, is an example of another type of capability that the government could provide. There are other opportunities out there as well, and I imagine people are thinking about it now.
Yeah, there. I've seen people bring up the old idea of a fuel depot, propellant depots in orbit. I think there was one company, I can't remember the name of it right now, but that was wanting to test one, which is great, given that, you know, I was working on those types of ideas like 15 years ago.
Right.
And
right.
Everybody kept telling you, oh, it's not worth it, and which is very annoying. But with that, unfortunately, we've ran out of time. But I think that hopefully we've gotten our audience to think through a little bit about how the strategic piece of space is not simply the launching of satellites. It's not simply saying you can get there. There is a real strategic reason for going. There is a reason for having a space force, and it's not just to be a modified Air Force Space Command for terrestrial support. It is for expanding out. It's for reaching out into the stars, as the president says, for benefits of us here on Earth. And I think personally, even with Musk's comment, I think we can do both.
Yes.
If he wants to do Mars, great. That'll just help us with our tech that we can utilize for other things. And I think this is going to be hopefully a very exciting next few years. I'm hopeful that this all comes to fruition.
Me too.
But for now, I would like to just thank Dr. Coyote Smith for coming on the show since we're out of time. Coyote, thanks again for coming on board.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, I'm Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.